Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information, security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. And boy oh boy, what a week for InfoSec news. In this week's weekly show, we're just going to drill into the security news with Adam Boileau, then go straight to the sponsor interview. I've got a fantastic feature interview for you this week, but I'm going to publish it outside of this show. It was either that or run stupidly long or cut too much from everything to make it all fit. So I'm trying something new, and that feature will be up in a couple of days. This week's sponsor interview is a good one, though. We're chatting with the team behind Darktrace. They make a machine learning-backed network monitor. A key difference with this kit is it actually gets involved on the network. If it sees something that's confident is attacker behavior, it'll start spraying TCP resets to boot that person off the network. Now, this is something IPS systems of old used to do on a signature match, but it's an approach that fell out of favor. We'll find out why that approach was discarded and why it's coming back, as well as generally have a discussion around the role of machine learning in security with a company that has invested in it heavily beyond things like malware file classification a la Cylance. This isn't a for or against interview segment. This is a discussion with one company that is getting value out of the approach on the network side. So I personally found it quite interesting, so please do stick around for that one. But first up, of course, it is time for a check of the week's security news. And there's a lot of news this week with Adam Boileau. And Adam, last week we speculated that Iran could get a little bit more active on the old internets following the United States withdrawal from the so-called Iran agreement and the Iran nuclear agreement. And right on cue.
Yes, we have an article saying that they have, in fact, ramped up their activity faster than we expected. I think last week on the show I said that, you know, they'll probably give it a little while before they kind of really start to pick it up. But no, straight to it. And they've been going around ramping up and hacking things. So
apparently they've been ramping up recon for like a couple of months. And then CrowdStrike sent out some alert saying, you know, within 24 hours of the announcement, the spearfish tsunami began.
Yes, they said there's been a notable shift in Iranian cyber activity within 24 hours of being announced. So clearly, I guess they were, as you say, gearing up in advance for what was going to happen. And, you know, whether this leads to complete open season, whether there's something in between, we're going to have to wait and see a little bit. But it is happening.
Now, I'm including this next story mostly out of sympathy, really, for Kevin Collier of BuzzFeed, who worked very hard on this story. And, it kind of got buried by the US news cycle over the last couple of weeks with everything that's just happening over there all the time. It's hard to keep up. But he's got a really interesting write-up about how the Gulf states have been using very selective doxing and, hacking to really manipulate the geopolitical agenda in the Middle East.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a very good write-up of, the use of, email leaks and hacking and, some so-called hacking, some actual hacking to advance political agendas, primarily between Qatar and, the UAE and Saudi and Kuwait. And in particular, some of the leaks that have been going on in the US, there was a bunch of, for example, salacious docs, emails leaked relating to the ambassador from the UAE to the United States and about him, hanging out with hookers and all the sorts of things you do when you're an ambassador. But the way that those have been leaked to specific journalists and news organizations to try and shape the debate and to, support the agendas in the region. I know we talked what was it last year when, the sort of the blockade of Qatar came into play. And there had been that, kind of fake news where the Qatari government site got hacked and a bunch of quotes attributed to their leader, praising Iran. And it turned out to be the UAE had paid some Russian freelancers to do it to kind of trigger off the excuse for the blockade of Qatar. And so it's a really good write-up of all of the very kind of complicated regional politics and how they're spilling over, into lobbying in the US, through the use of hacking and hack techniques and primarily, compromised email accounts. It's a really good piece.
Mail spools is geopolitics, basically. And, Iran is a very big part of this as well. And, people trying to influence relations between various parties in Iran based on strategic leaks. And it's just, look, it really is a great write-up showing how, mail spools have become quite important to global affairs.
Yeah, the quote that stood out to me was, I think it said, the unfolding battle alarms transparency advocates who fear it will usher in the era in which computer hacking and the dissemination of hacked emails will become the norm in international foreign policy disputes. It's like, what do you mean will become? Like, yeah, totally yeah. already has. Like, a little late there.
That's- and that was the discussion that we had when WikiLeaks first became a thing, you know? Like, that was really what that was all about. Like, with the State Department leaks years ago, it was very much along those lines of, well, people won't write anything down anymore. And, you know, email for such a crappy protocol is still the way the world runs. Basically, the world is run on email and it's not going to change anytime soon.
No, and of course, people's email will continue to get owned pretty much for the rest of the time. But yeah, it's just, you know, it's. I was reminded reading this article of your, what, keynote of KiwiCon 2, 3, whatever three, it was, I think it was, you know, yeah, you know, 8, 9 years ago, you know, pretty much on the subject. I mean, on the use of hacking and fake news and, you know, presaging, all of this kind of stuff. So, yeah, you journos are out on the front line.
Now, look, let's turn our attention to the mess at the White House, because it is just, my God, you know, I mean, we've just discussed two stories about how computer-related stuff is becoming extremely important to global affairs. And we've got a handful of stories here that we've got to get through. First up, the National Security Council in the United States has delayed its publication of its cyber strategy, you know, because obviously Rob Joyce would have put something sensible together and, you know, that won't do because he's now left. So they've paused that. Now, I'm guessing they're just sprinkling the crack dust into it as we speak.
Yeah, the according to Politico, apparently internal factions have been like lobbying to delay and kind of undermine this, specifically to stick it to Joyce on his last day in the office, which, you know, on one hand is super petty and on the other hand is also exactly what you expect. And then, yeah, of course, as you say, it's probably too sensible.
It's good to know they have the best interests of the country at heart.
Exactly, yeah. No, it's just, it's super depressing. And of course, you know, the cybers could not be more relevant politically, you know, than they have been any time in the last, you know, 10, 15 years. And yet, you know, the US government's in the middle of just, you know, making a complete cock-up of it for, you know, entirely rubbish internal, you know, sort of jockeying for position rather than anything, you know, actually important.
Yeah. Rob Joyce is a listener, too, of this show, I discovered some time ago. So, Rob, you will be missed. I just want to say that on mic. Now, look, staying with that, the White House cybersecurity coordinator position has been eliminated, absolutely eliminated. There will be no replacement for Rob Joyce. The walrus himself, John Bolton, has decided that, you know, there's nothing going on the internet, so why would we need this role?
Yeah, they've solved the cybers now. Job done. You know, let's cut that unnecessary, what is it called? Unnecessary bureaucracy. Another layer of bureaucracy is the
I think it's more like unnecessary knowledge and expertise, which seems to be something yeah, exactly, they're really not like about.
Oh, inconvenient God. Truths.
Yes.
Expert opinions not welcome here.
But look, I mean, people are so alarmed in the United States. We've even got Congress people throwing together bills to try to protect this position and sort of enshrine that cybersecurity coordinator role into law, which is just amazing.
Yeah, it is quite startling, isn't it? I mean, I think in this case, what we've got Ted Lieu, who's like the only US politician who used to be a pen tester, I think, you know, arguing for a, you know, separate office in the executive branch that would cover this kind of coordination of policy, you know, across all the departments because it's so important. And yeah, you know, seeing, I guess, Democrats argue for, you know, more positions in the White House doesn't seem like exactly what you'd intuitively expect, which kind of underlines how important it is. But, you know, but no, we can't have nice things.
Now, U.S. authorities may have solved a bit of a mystery. In fact, they may have solved this mystery around August last year by charging an ex-CIA contractor, Joshua Adam Schultz, with possession of child exploitation material. But it looks like the real reason that he got his doors kicked in is because he's the likely source of the Vault 7, the so-called Vault 7 CIA tooling material that was dropped on WikiLeaks. So this is a big story.
Yes, apparently he was an employee at one point at the NSA and then at the CIA in the Directorate of Science and Technology. Apparently he developed some of the tools, quick reactions capabilities, apparently they're called, some of the tools. And yeah, looks like he has, well, the story is that he was the source for that material, presumably had it hoarded at home for whatever reasons, although I'm not quite sure whether it's another, you know, another Harold Martin sort of situation going on. We haven't seen the details.
You mean another Kaspersky user situation?
Yeah, public Kaspersky user, yes. But no, apparently they, you know, correlated who had access to the material about the right time, and then he was one of the people that came up, and they executed some warrants on his place, and yes, amongst other things, turned up child exploitation material. But we haven't really seen charges beyond that yet, although, I mean, clearly it's not going well for him.
Yeah, well, I mean, that guy who had been charged with, like, mishandling classified information or whatever, who turned out to be the source of CIA leaks that got, you know, basically the CIA's entire China network rolled up and executed, you know, he was charged with something very similar, and now, you know, more serious charges there. So that's the pattern these things seem to follow, is they get them with what they can get them with, and then they build a case. I should correct myself too, because he wasn't, for once, it wasn't a contractor. It was actually staff. I'm just amazed he doesn't work for Booz Allen.
Yes, apparently.
You know, I mean, they're probably popping the corks at Booz Allen Hamilton today.
Yeah.
Finally, someone got arrested for leaking highly classified material, and it wasn't one of our people. Hooray!
Yay, amazing, amazing.
Now, lots of arm flapping, lots of running around. And you know what? The best thing about doing this podcast with you, Adam, every week, is that I didn't even have to read this stuff, because I know these are the sort of stories that you just can't help yourself. You follow them closely. Talk me through the PGP and GP and S-MIME flap, because I could not be bothered following this.
Yeah, well, frankly, you made the right choice, and unfortunately, you're also right, and I did read it all.
Yeah.
Because,
you
yes, that,
that's what you do.
I couldn't help myself.
Metal's going to metal.
Yes. Anyway, so a story started to brew that there was going to be a release of some kind of critical security flaw involving PGP, the mail crypto protocol. It was kind of teased on, you know, before it was, whilst it was still embargoed, before it was released. And it got written up kind of hysterically by, you know, the EFF, and picked up by a couple of other news outlets, Ars Technica, for example. And kind of the further you got from the original source, which was a bunch of academic researchers who've done some really good crypto research in the past, the further you got away from it, like, the more hysterical it got, basically saying people will be able to decrypt previous PGP emails that you've sent and to uninstall PGP or stop using PGP.
The coverage flowed from the screen like a river of screams.
It really did, eh? And it was it really wasn't clear what was going on. And you know, a lot of us got kind of concerned. I mean, a bug in GPG or a bug in PGP, either a crypto one or an actual implementation one.
Well, retrospective decryption of, you know, past mail, that's a pretty big deal.
It is a pretty big deal.
Until you find out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, let me just, before we get to the what actually happened, like, the thing that concerned me, of course, is that PGP is, you know, PGP email is pretty much just crypto nerds and journos and a few other, you know.
Well, and defense departments and a few of them, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's not, I mean, in the end, it's not the major use case for PGP anymore. These days, it's more about software supply chain, right? We use it to sign packages and software distributions, to sign code updates. Like, it's got a bunch of really important uses that aren't confidentiality, right, that are signature validation. And that was the thing that what I was worried about. Anyway, turned out not the case. What actually happened here, and the bug that they've got when it finally dropped, and actually it got dropped early because the GPG developers got a bit salty about the coverage, which kind of fair enough because it wasn't really their fault. They got a bit salty and dropped the details early, and then it all kind of snowballed out of it. But anyway, the bug is that if you have a mail client, which will automatically decrypt PGP mail, and the mail is crafted in such a way to cause the resulting clear text content to be HTML or something else that has some way of exfilling data, that then they use that as a primitive to exfil clear text mail. So using your mail client as a, you know, sort of an oracle to decrypt messages or decrypt portions of message and send them to you through abuse of the cipher mode used in the encryption process. So in this case, they came up with actually quite a novel, or at least to me, not being a super crypto expert, I mean, a relatively novel way of doing kind of block shuffling attacks on the actual encrypted blocks and using interaction between the PGP compression and the crypto to kind of manipulate the contents of the plain text using known plain texts in the mail. So mail headers and things that the attacker can predict. So quite a clever crypto attack, but then it really just got kind of blown out of proportion.
Now, when they talk about historical mail, I'm assuming that the, you know, the recipient, the original recipient of that mail, what they need to, like, how does that work? Because that's where I started to get really lost.
So the attack here is if you have stored encrypted mail in the past, through passive intercept of SMTP, like an intelligence agency would, that you could then use this to have the mail client of the user decrypt old content that you had
by sending it to them.
By sending it to them or sending crafted variations of the mail to them, assuming the keys haven't changed over time.
Why don't you just pop their box and steal their keys?
Well, of course, that's the thing, right? And that's why thick client applications like Thunderbird or Apple Mail that have PGP implementation, PGP integrated, and have HTML rendering have always been a terrible idea and are increasingly so as those applications become more and more niche. And I think that's one of the reasons why PGP really has fallen in popularity is that no one uses a thick mail client anymore. Everyone uses Gmail or Outlook.com, web-based stuff. And I know, 4, 5, 6 years ago, when I still ran Thunderbird for email, and I still used, GPG on the desktop, and I used Pigeon with OTR for crypto because, Cypherpunk's going to Cypherpunk, right? We want to crypt our comms. And Ben Hawkes, who now runs Project Zero at Google, I think maybe at the time he was still sitting like a desk over from me. And he said, why are you trading off transport crypto, for which protects you against very few attackers, for client-side complexity that everybody can only through rubbish bugs and Pigeon
LibOTR was a horror show, and so trivially exploitable. And like it just gives an attacker such a clear path right onto your stack, man.
Exactly, right? And so, and as a result of that conversation with Ben, right, I changed a whole bunch of my personal OPSEC practices because of that, right? And ditched Pigeon, ditched LibOTR.
I do not use messaging clients anymore at all.
No, because it's a bad trade-off, right? You're getting security from people who are on the wire, but you are trading off against all of the bugs in complicated client software. And this is a perfect example of, there isn't a problem with the crypto other than the arguments that you could solve this by using authenticated encryption, which has been in the standard for ages and no one's adopted because interop, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, the point is this is a client-side complexity thing, getting around avoiding the crypto and you not getting what you thought you did because of the complexity of the software. Anyway, so the second aspect of this whole story, of course, is not just PGP, but S/MIME, which is, of course, the alternative encrypted messaging format, which in some ways is actually worse than the PGP one because the PGP one's a little more complicated because of compression and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, there's a bunch of people who use S/MIME inside other products. There are encrypted messaging gateway products that use S/MIME for transport, and all of those are not necessarily going to be subject to the same level of scrutiny as Thunderbird and Outlook and Apple Mail and stuff that we can look at because they're closed products. And so I'm more worried with this particular bug with gateway-based crypto where there isn't any user interaction to spot weird messages coming in and where there may be other side channels to exfil data from the decryption process. The eFail paper, when they actually did release it, did have a small section on gateway crypto and another section on how to use back channels to exfil data that don't rely on HTML, so using, for example, properties of X509 decryption, so certificate revocation lists or OCSP validation or whatever to exfil stuff. Anyway, I think that is probably the more interesting part of this bug than the PGP bit, and all of the "oh my god, delete your PGP."
Yeah, that was pretty funny. But I mean,
probably isn't going to help.
These aren't permabugs, though, are they? I mean, in the case of the client side one, patch the clients. In the case of the S/MIME thing, suggest patches in the standard that all of the vendors ignore, but we'll just say it's patch the servers.
Yeah, and I think certainly the basic advice that the EFF gave and that the authors gave, which kind of got lost in the hype, which was just turn off HTML rendering in your mail, is a really good first step.
It's probably
the other
good
avenues,
general advice anyway.
Well, it is, right? It's always been a terrible idea to use rich mail with PGP. There's been a bunch of this used in the past in this kind of style. So, not in this style from the crypto sense. The manipulation of the plain text from outside, like that's cool, but just like sending stuff inside the HTML that exploits the client is a thing that's totally happened before. So yeah, that's good advice, full stop. Like, use PGP in the most basic way possible, to handle text files in a controlled environment that doesn't have network connectivity, and then you can use it safely, but don't expect, rich email with, cat GIFs and good crypto. And of course, we'll talk a bit later on about what happens when you mix other rich interfaces with crypto in the second part of the crypto fail story of the week.
So yeah, speaking of that, there has been another flap this week that was actually quite entertaining to watch. And I think a good place to start this story is with a Spider Labs blog post about bugs in Electron, which spoke about bugs in the sort of electron frameworky type thing. And of course, Spider Labs, you know, good research, and they named a whole bunch of apps that used Electron, including Signal, which set off a huge flap of people saying, well, do you know Signal is vulnerable or is Signal not vulnerable? You're just trying to get headlines. And then the second part of the story kicks in and it all gets very funny. But let's start with the Electron thing.
All right. So, yeah, Electron, for those aren't familiar, is a framework that's used for kind of building rich desktop apps using web tech. Slack, Signal, I think Spotify maybe is Electron as well. You know, there's a bunch of apps that are built in it that are relatively widely used because it just means web devs can build rich client apps that work well and have all of the nice bits. Anyway, the TrustWave Spider Labs blog post is talking about a particular technique for like turning cross-site scripting in Electron apps into code execution through kind of a an interesting trick in the way that basically escaping the JavaScript sandbox inside the that is running the Electron app. If you've got cross-site scripting, then you can leverage it into code exec in this particular scenario. And it's really, you know, for those of us who've hacked on Electron apps, it's quite a cool technique. It's useful and likely to work in a bunch of places. So that was great. But then, as you say, that blew up into can you hack Signal with it? And I don't think that Signal was vulnerable to this particular technique. And, of course, this is a you've got a cross-site script, then what can you do with it kind of thing, not a, as some of the reports wrote it up as a cross-site scripting issue, which it isn't. Anyway, so that happened, and there was lots of hand-wringing from Signal users, and then, like, literally the next day, cross-site scripting in Signal.
Completely in unrelated to this one, but it was just glorious the way that this unfolded.
And it was, yeah. So it turned out that you could get cross-site scripting into the Signal desktop app. Now, in this case, you couldn't use this particular TrustWave trick to turn it into code exec, but it would have been sweet if you could.
Yeah.
Cross-site scripting, it involved it involved HTML injection and then pulling script in using like Windows UNC paths to avoid the CSP, the content security protection that was otherwise preventing script injection. So Signal on desktop on Windows cross-site scripting was pretty sweet.
Yeah, I got to say though, the people who found this are tweeting that they found that it's a remote code exec. Like calling it RCE is a bit cheeky.
It is a bit cheeky. I mean, and I think that was one of the things that in combination with this TrustWave thing, like people were expecting that it was going to use that trick or that they had some other trick. But I think reading it wrong, but it did look like it was just script injection into the Signal app, which was still bad. And I guess in the context of an app that's running, it is written in JavaScript, it's kind of code exec, but it's still sandboxed inside the node runtime in the Electron framework. So
I'm happy to say,
like we would normally describe it.
And, you know, just as I don't use Pigeon with libotr, I'm happy to put my hand on my heart and say I don't use any desktop applications for Signal or WhatsApp.
Just for
this exact reason,
right?
Like you got the world's most secure device in your hand. You know, let's plumb that through to our desktop running on a, 25-year-old code base, really. It doesn't seem like a good idea. And then Lorenzo over at Motherboard chipped in with a story about how, and yeah, I'm in two minds about this one, right? Like they mentioned that these disappearing Signal messages, because they pop up as notifications on OS X, that they, those disappearing messages don't disappear and there's a log of them on your system if you're using Signal desktop, which, okay, I understand that's a concern. That's something that people should know. But having had a little bit of experience playing around with anonymous messaging clients or, private messaging clients, I can tell you that's not the only risk for messages getting left around. Like virtual memory is your real enemy here.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly all sorts of ways that stuff's going to end up in the clear. I mean, there's internal message buses. I mean, I think like on Linux on the desktop, there's, equivalent messaging frameworks to on OS X. And as you say, swap files on disk and, all sorts of stuff can go wrong.
Keeping stuff out of swap files is actually kind of hard.
Yeah, well, I mean, in the end, you're going to need to have encrypted swap or no swap at all. It's tough.
Look, I don't mind saying, and tell me what you think about this, but I don't mind saying that you just shouldn't run these desktop apps that plumb through your phone to, do your private messaging. It just seems like a bad idea to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think you make the cogent point. You have the world's most secure device in your hand. The only thing it doesn't have is a keyboard. Maybe plug a keyboard in rather than connecting the app to your desktop, which is, full of horrible software.
I really wish you could get Signal without a phone number, because I think Signal on an iPad with a Bluetooth keyboard, oh baby, that'd be amazing.
That would certainly be convenient, yes.
Yeah, it would. Now, oh my God. Okay, so we're on to the this story. This story has everything. Now, I think it was last week or the week before, we spoke about ZTE, the China carrier, or ZTE for our American friends. Now, they, of course, got busted some years ago violating sanctions. They were selling an awful lot of equipment to North Korea, to Iran. They got fined $1.2 billion. They paid the fine, and then they got in trouble again because they had promised as part of their undertakings to punish the people who are responsible for violating these sanctions. They didn't do that. So now the US has sanctioned ZTE, saying, you know, certain suppliers could not supply them parts. This has resulted in ZTE basically, like, all activities ceasing. People are sitting around at head office in China with nothing to do. So the company is toast. Now, this comes on hot on the heels of like a report from the UK NCSC saying that, you know, ZTE, no one should use their carrier equipment. The carrier equipment that has already been used is, I think they called it, an, you know, a risk that cannot be mitigated currently. So they're just hoping for that equipment to sort of die and get out of their networks. So, you know, ZTE, very bad actor, made a lot of mistakes, going out of business due to the actions of the United States government. Also, the Pentagon has banned all stores on U.S. military bases worldwide to ban phones and equipment from Huawei and ZTE after warnings from the intelligence community. So, you know, lots of strikes against ZTE. Now, okay, you think that's said and done. Wow, what an amazing thing, where a multinational company has been just wiped off the face of the earth because of bad behavior. Cue a tweet from Mr. Make America Great Again himself, Donald Trump. I'm going to read the tweet. President Xi of China and I are working together to give massive Chinese phone company ZTE a way to get back into business fast. Too many jobs in China lost. Commerce Department has been instructed to get it done. Make China great again. Okay, I added that last part, but you hear what I'm saying. This is just so weird.
It is. It's such a bizarre story. And it starts so well in a way. I mean, the idea that the fourth largest, you know, mobile phone vendor in the US would be, you know, given the corporate death penalty for breaking sanctions and selling stuff. Like, that's really, like, I was amazed that they had been, that they'd actually done it instead of just weaseling, you know, instead of it just being like saying, hey, Qualcomm aren't going to sell you chips anymore and Corning's not going to sell you glass for your phones and you're going to go out of business tough. Like, that was, yeah, I was shocked and you know, sort of strangely surprised that is what had happened.
Yeah, no, I had that same reaction, which is it was bizarre and it was tough, but like, okay, this sends a message, right? Yeah. So maybe Huawei are going to like maybe turn it down a little bit, you know? You're thinking, geez, maybe other companies that are dealing with the US won't violate sanctions.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it seemed like a really sensible move in a way because it sends all the right messages and, you know, let's face it, selling stuff, you know, what's the point of sanctioning North Korea or sanctioning Iran if you then go and walk it back? Oh, wait, hang on a second. but yeah, it seemed like a sensible thing. And then, of course, as you would expect, Trump turns around and you know, flip-flops and changes his mind.
I did not expect that, considering he ran on an entire platform of bringing jobs back to the US from China. And now he's literally tweeting about protecting Chinese jobs. I think someone described it, and it's the best description. They described it as off-brand.
Well, yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I don't know what's going on. I mean, next week maybe ZTE will be back in business. Maybe they won't. Who knows what's going on here?
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, certainly at the very least, if you've got a bunch of ZTE equipment in your network, A, you already had a problem. B, you're probably not going to get security patches. I mean, even if you were going to. So you might want to think about that. And C, I guess sell your stock. I don't know. I don't even know what's happening.
And I don't know if Trump's going to be able to reverse this. I've got no idea what's happening. But I just, you know, it's such a 2018 President Donald J. Trump story. And it's just, we have to talk about it. Now, look, this story broke last week. And I didn't include it in the news because, and I'm of course talking about Microsoft including like JavaScript functionality in Excel, right? So the whole idea is, you know, people are jumping up and down and going, JavaScript in Excel, what a terrible idea. And the reason I didn't want to talk about it last week is because I just had this feeling it was probably a bit of a nothing burger. And depending on who you talk to, it's either a nothing burger or it's a wrong turn. I'm leaning heavily towards this being a nothing burger because you have to put add-ins in and it's, I don't know, it seems to be pretty carefully integrated. But you tell me, Adam, what's the go with Microsoft Excel now allowing JavaScript in Sheets?
I don't think it's a big deal. I mean, it already had a general purpose, you know, Turing complete programming tool in it in the form of Visual Basic and has forever. So, I mean, anything you could do in JavaScript, you could already do in VB. It was just less pleasant. I mean, to the extent that it's pleasant in JavaScript, which is not very, but like VB, you could do it all in VB anyway.
But I think they've actually done this in a more sensible way to the way VB's integrated as well. Like it's they've thought about this.
Well, exactly right. They've got the benefit of having had VB in Excel for 25 years, and they can learn from the lessons. And of course, JavaScript already exists and is used in a sandboxed context. We already know a whole bunch about sandboxing JavaScript. So, yeah, I mean, I think if anything, a JavaScript integration into Excel now is going to be way better than the current VB integration into Excel you would expect, just from the level of maturity of the sandboxing and what we kind of know about how to do that well. So, yeah, I don't think... I mean, you know, it's, of course it's made headlines because people are like, oh, I can mine, you know, Bitcoin or Monero or whatever in Excel now. It's like, well, you could do that in VB too.
That's another one that I included in this week's show notes is some company like Party Trick Hacking. They made an Excel sheet that like mines crypto coin and JavaScript.
Yeah, well, which, you know, whoop-de-doo, right?
Yeah, I know, right? But like it was a way to grab some headlines and, you know, it was successful at doing that. So well done. Last week we spoke about some Rowhammer stuff affecting Android. So cool. Yeah, Android GPUs. This is like next level Rowhammering. This is amazing.
These couple of researchers from University of Amsterdam and University of Cyprus, five academics from the University of Amsterdam and University of Cyprus, have come up with a technique for doing Rowhammer over the network into the memory map network buffer of the network card. Like, how cool is this?
Yes!
The caveat, of course, being that you have to be on a 10 gig network and the network card has to use like direct DMA. So this way you've got the network card directly talking DMA in domain memory, so that it works fast, which for a 10 gig network card, you might actually don't need. Anyway, they demonstrated this against, I think it was Memcache. So they're committing data into and reading from the Memcache over the network directly through the network card's RDMA to do Rowhammering. That's just super cool. Let's face it, very few people have an attacker directly 10 gig connected to them and are running, you know, RDMA network cards, but
what a way to own really someone. Cool. Yeah. Now, we've spoken a few times about this crazy bill in Georgia in the United States that would criminalize unauthorized access regardless of intent and allow people to hack back. And, you know, Atlanta... There's a lot of InfoSec companies in Atlanta. I mean, Internet Security Systems back in the day, they were an Atlanta company. I mean, they got a lot of IBM there as well. So, I mean, it just seemed like such a weird law. The governor in Georgia is vetoing it. He has vetoed it. So thank God for that.
So sad. So sad. Like, well, as I said last time we talked about this, I was kind of looking forward to see what chaos would happen if they passed the hack back, you know, legitimizing law. But no, it's been vetoed. Very sad. I'm disappointed, Georgia. I was hoping, but no.
You wanted the chaos. You wanted more to talk about. Kevin Paulson. Kevin Paulson filed an excellent story for the Daily Beast, talking about a Chrome plugin that that the Russian sort of SIGINTers, you know, the bears came up with that basically helped them do like clicks and likes on Facebook and stuff. And it's just a great little dive into one tool that. You know, I guess you'd call it the retail tool. It's on the retail side. It was stuff that they're actually pushing out to users to perform a function. But, you know, it's just hilarious that, you know, you're hijacking some 16-year-old girl's computer to like weird racist posts on Facebook.
It's such a 2018 story, isn't it? This was a thing called Face Music. So, yeah, it was a Chrome add-on thing that would play music in Facebook, and they bought targeted ads for teenage girls, which was the hook in the title, to kind of install this thing so they could browse, listen to music whilst they were browsing Facebook. And then, yeah, it was basically used to proxy web requests to inflate, you know, clicks and likes and whatever else to promote their content. The other thing that was funny about the story, and I guess Kevin Paulson, you know, showing his roots a little bit here, is they registered the abandoned C2 domain for it and started jacking inbound connections from some of these agents that are still live, because Google had said, oh, we've removed this from the Chrome store and we've also pushed out the thing to Chrome that causes it to remove plugins that we've removed from the store. But of course, there actually were still a bunch, you know, 100 or so still live on the internet that hadn't, you know, I guess got the message from Google. So yeah, Paulson ran up a C2 and collected a bunch of information about them. So that was pretty cool too.
That's a good way to do journalism and the sort of thing that Kevin does pretty regularly. So nice work, mate. The Dutch have ditched Kaspersky, not because they say they've observed nefarious behavior, but, you know, as we've said on the show a million times, the mere fact that they are a Russian headquartered company and, you know, Russia doesn't seem too concerned with law and order when it comes to, you know, telling people to do things that they might not want to do. So, the Dutch have basically said no more Kaspersky because it's too big a risk. And this is something we've been expecting.
Yeah, and I think this is a real, you know, a real inflection point in a way that it isn't about any specific thing they've done.
Well, and the other thing is too, like Kaspersky, like, so what? The US is only 10% of our market share or something like that. And now when you start seeing, you know, Western European countries saying nope, this has real potential to snowball. And I would be very worried if I was, I know they're not a listed company, but if you were a shareholder in Kaspersky, you'd be a bit concerned right now.
Yeah, well, you certainly would. But I think it's, you know, it's a real beginning point where we do start to look at the, you know, sort of the loyalties of the supply chain, right? Whether they are natural loyalties, like patriotic loyalties, or whether they are, you know, coercive loyalties where, you know, the state has the monopoly of violence upon you and can make you do whatever you wish. And I think this is, you know, this is an important thing to take note of, that we are seeing, you know, the beginning of a balkanization of the supply chain across national lines. I mean, what's the, you know, how long before Russia turns around and says, you're not allowed to use Windows in Russia anymore?
Well,
because it's an American headquartered company. Like, I mean, that's a thing that could actually happen.
It is, but we don't have any documented cases of like American companies being coerced. Like if you look at that Flame, the Flame malware that used an MD5 collision
to get
a Windows update patch to be swallowed by a target system. Like the easier path might have been going to Microsoft and saying, hey, can you sign this for me? But I don't believe they can do that legally. And, you know, I think there are some protections for American companies there, and the IC has decided they don't want to go down that path. So it is kind of a different kettle of fish. And you have to say that the Americans, and I know a lot of people won't believe this and won't believe that I'm saying it, but the Americans have sort of demonstrated that they don't really want to screw around with their tech industry too much by pulling that sort of thing, right? Because I think I said it on the show a while ago and it got a bit of a reaction, that comment, but you know, America isn't one nation under God. It's one nation under the dollar. You know, they don't want to mess with their commerce.
Yeah, and actually there is a story a bit further on in the news list, which is specifically about introducing a bill to prevent backdoors in, you know, comms tech and stuff by U.S. companies at the behest of the U.S. government, specifically to stop U.S. products and services being less attractive overseas, right? So, yeah, you're right. It's very much in, you know, more ingrained in the American psyche to worship the dollar than to be, you know, used as a tool by your government for whatever.
That's right. And the US, meanwhile, is mulling sanctions against Kaspersky. And look, I'm at the point now where I just feel like if the US is going to do that, they need to give a reason. You know, I mean, they really need to. They can't just sanction this company out of existence without making a public case. I don't think that's right. And I don't think they should do it.
Yeah, although on the other hand, that's what the Dutch just did, so.
Well, no, they didn't sanction the company. They banned use of the stuff in government computers. Like, there is a big difference between that and then freezing a company's assets and forbidding it from doing business.
You're right.
You know, like, it is a whole different universe of hurt that they'll be laying on Kaspersky then. So, yeah, we'll have to wait and see on that. Now a huge kerfuffle in the US as well over reports that law enforcement can just basically get unfettered access to real-time cell phone tracking data through, I think, is it marketing companies? But this is just, people have read this and their brains have just gone.
Yeah, this report kind of blew up for a couple of organizations that provide, you know, web-based access to phone location data. One of them is actually like a phone operator for prison services or something, and you can kind of, you know, upload a, you know, PDF that says I am authorized to ask for information, and there's no checking done at all. You enter the phone number and they'll give you location data. Now there's a bunch of firms that do this, and they all seem to get the data from a bunch of other intermediaries that then collect it from the various mobile phone operators in the US. And it does seem that the phone operators are selling location data to, you know, third-party data aggregators who are then on-selling and eventually it's showing up as kind of retail services for people. And that's not really a thing that the phone carriers are meant to do. And we've seen some letters being sent from Senator Ron Wyden's office, probably via Chris Sahoyan, you know, kind of asking the phone companies to explain exactly who they're selling the data to and why and how they feel that this is in line with their obligations to not do that without this explicit consent of the users. And, you know, clearly a lot of people in the US are worried about having their location discovered by people who, you know, they don't want to.
Now, look, you did just mention this next piece that we're going to speak to, where the, you know, some politicians in the United States are proposing a bill that would ban so-called backdoors, you know, going into US technology. But is that focused on the Kaspersky case, or is it focused on the domestic law enforcement and intelligence case? Because I'm not sure, like, where it's directed, or is it both?
Well, I mean, so this is the Secure Data Act that's being, you know, that would prevents the government from asking companies to introduce backdoors. And I think this is primarily a reaction to the, you know, sort of the Apple versus the FBI, you know.
So it's more about the domestic stuff, but they're saying as a benefit of that, then their technology is naturally going to be more trusted overseas.
Yeah, well, it's the quote that's pulled in the article on CyberScoop from Representative Thomas Massey, who's one of the sponsors of the bill, is that backdoors and otherwise secure products make Americans' data less safe and they compromise the desirability of American goods overseas, which really does put them both on quite even footing in that particular soundbite. But I'm, you know, you kind of get the feeling that it started more with the Apple side of things.
Yes.
And, you know, that's a nice benefit that you don't end up getting ZTE'd or Kaspersky'd.
Yeah, I'm skeptical that a bill like that's going to get up, because I think the, you know, the NatSec people will get in a room with the Congress people and scare the crap out of them, and that'll be the end of that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I don't know that it's going to go anywhere, but this is kind of part of this ongoing, you know, sort of running battle between the two, you know, the going dark side and the, you know, we must have proper crypto or it's a terrible thing kind of side. So
Now, look, we could be seeing the beginnings of a scandal, a corporate accounting scandal now with, of all companies, Symantec might not be as profitable as its recently published financial results might suggest, Adam.
Womp, womp. Yes, yeah. Apparently there is an ongoing internal audit, the details of which have not yet been released, or, you know, really the sort of speculation going on. The investigation is, quote, in its early stages, unquote, said the company. However, the shareholders and the stock market certainly have feelings about it, because Symantec's stock tanked 30%. I guess people are worried.
Yeah, they are. And I think they also said that they might need to revise previous filings. And this harks back for me. I mean, this just has all of the shades of, and, you know, a lot of people won't remember this, but because it was 10 plus years ago, but CA, you know, what was Computer Associates and then became CA.
My favorite.
Yeah, huge accounting scandal there. Well, Symantec kind of is the new CA, right? Like it's become the enterprise software graveyard. It's where good software goes to die.
I thought that was OpenText. But anyway, yeah, no, you're right. I mean, Symantec really have lost their shine over the years, and certainly their certificate business did not do particularly well. VeriSign now spun off into whatever it's called.
Yeah, but
that
was never really a big part of Symantec's cash, you know, like.
No, but I think it really played to their credibility in a way, though. Like,
true,
the fact
true.
That they got kind of dragged over the coals so much for mishandling that, you know, the fact that, you know, Symantec and Norton has been a rubbish AV, well, relatively rubbish, I guess. It's still worse. But the fact that it has been relatively rubbish for, you know, a reasonable period of time and not, I don't think, innovated on in quite a while is, you know, is kind of being spelt out in what's going on for them.
Now, I picked this next one up because, you know, it's kind of frustrating for me because this is stuff we were speaking about years ago, which is that APT28, Fancy Bear, has been posing as ISIS in a bunch of attacks, you know, the so-called, you know, cyber caliphate. And, you know, we were speaking about this after TV5 Monde got owned and, you know, it looked like Islamic State, but it was very quickly determined that it was not Islamic State. And of course, we were talking about this before the whole DNC kerfuffle. So it's just weird to see this emerging as a headline and lawmakers focusing on this now, when really most people in InfoSec have known about this for the past 3 years.
Yeah, I mean, who knew that attribution could be more complicated than, oh my God, it came from a, you know, an IP in a particular country?
But it wasn't even that. I mean, like, okay, they put up their cyber caliphate imagery, but all of the TTPs were Russia, man. Like, it was like it was the most half-assed, like, misdirection you've ever seen.
But that's, I guess that's the thing, right? I mean, if you look across the stories we've talked through in the news so far today, like something like, what, fully three quarters of them are either Russian state pretending to be, you know, somebody, Russian freelancers providing the skills. Some of the Iranian malware we saw used in Saudi Arabia is being attributed to Russian technology that's been shared with the Iranians. We're seeing the Russian fingerprints in a whole lot of places. And I guess it's nice in a way that at least we are seeing it written up a little further afield than just, you know, you and me and InfoSec people who actually do technical attribution. So I think it's good that it's being, you know, acknowledged a bit more widely, perhaps.
Yeah. Oh, man, this next one. A whole bunch of SIGINTers are no doubt fuming because there was this so-called Zupark group doing a whole bunch of espionage on Android devices across the Middle East, and they had terrible OPSEC. And I'm guessing that half the world's, you know, SIGINT agencies were monitoring this group through their own CNC. But some vigilante just, you know, like a bull in a china shop, just ransacked the joint and then RF'd their CNC and burned it all down and gave Lorenzo a bunch of the data.
Yeah, apparently so. This guy claims that he just like file up, like read the Kaspersky piece, found the C2 box, file uploaded like a PDF.
Yeah, this is a group that Kaspersky had written up, and then they're like, oh, that's C2. There's the IP address. File include bang shell exfil burn it down.
Yep, and yeah, passed it off to Lorenzo. So, yeah.
Some funny quotes in here. Like they're like, "Oh, wouldn't it be good if Hackback was a thing, and then Kaspersky could have done this themselves?" And it's like, you think Kaspersky didn't do this?
Yeah, what makes you think that? It's kind of funny in that sort of, you know, trad 90s black hat sort of way, but I'm sure it, as you say, ruined a lot of SIGINT agencies' days.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, the Pakistani military has been using Facebook Messenger to spread, you know, some real low-grade, dumb Android APK malware, but apparently they're having some success with it, which is just, you know, facepalm.
Is pretty facepalm. Like, it's actual, like, spouseware kind of grade stuff.
They farmed it out to someone on freelancer.com for $50 an hour. Like, that is how espionage is done these days. Freelancer.com, $50 an hour to get your, you know, hacked up spouseware APKs installed on, you know, diplomats' phones, for God's sake.
Yeah, which is just, it's tragic, but hey, it works, right? I mean, if that's all you got to do to hack stuff, then, and apparently it is, right, is lure, you know, catfish people on Facebook Messenger to install your free, you know, free video messenger APK and job done, then, well, you know, it does make you wonder what, you know, we Five Eyes are spending all of our billions of, you know, NatSec dollars on when we could just spend $50 an hour on
Exactly. Freelancer. Yeah, I mean, you know, now Craigslist isn't just used for hookers. Maybe they could just Craigslist this stuff and, you know, world-class APTs at your fingertips. So there you go. Hey, new tricks in the DDoS arena. And this is actually kind of clever and simple and a good idea, but they're using UPnP to kind of confuse basic like DDoS blocking tech, which means that like really if you want to block this stuff, you need to roll DPI, which doesn't really scale that well. And it's just funny. Walk us through it.
This is kind of bizarre actually that you would go to this extent. But anyway, this is using UPnP to configure like, you configure the NAT on people's routers to kind of pivot your DDoS through, which we've seen people do before, but this is specifically seems to be using it to pivot other DDoSing. So like in this case, pivoting DNS amplified connections, DNS traffic amplified DDoS through the UPnP so that you send a spoof request into the device and then it sends it to another name server, generates the big response, and then NATs it back to the real destination that you spoofed your source from, which seems super convoluted to do. Like I'm sure there's good reasons.
Windows 10 is getting OpenSSH like the client. That's going to be good. as of April 2018, and attackers everywhere are rejoicing because you know, this is just such a
wonderful day. Oh, so good. Yeah, no, they are in fact packaging honest to God compiled from source OpenSSH, and actually not just OpenSSH, like the server, like the client, the server, but also a bunch of other stuff like tar and curl, which is so good.
It is.
And you know what the best bit is?
Tell me.
They're signed by Microsoft. Oh, yeah,
no. I was going to say, right? Like, it's just signed. It's like, it's there. It's official Windows software, which is fantastic, right?
Good. Having SSH, which is just such a wonderful, full-featured, you know, hacker backdoor tool,
yeah,
in the official build, signed by Microsoft, like application whitelisting, except anything signed by Microsoft. Job done. Job so done. Good.
Yeah, happy days. Happy.
Thank
happy.
You, Microsoft. Wonderful. Much appreciated. I mean, yeah, obviously it's just one of the tools in the box, but like living off the land is the new hotness, right? And now they're taking PowerShell away from
now
us.
Now the land is fertile and rich with many streams flowing through it and farmable land.
They wrecked PowerShell so much with all of the logging, and now they've given us OpenSSH. Like, hallelujah, what a great trade-off.
Woohoo. Great story from Bleeping Computer. Apparently malicious apps that get booted off the Play Store, the Android Play Store. The people who are maintaining these malware horror shows just change the name, resubmit them, and bang, they're back in. Well done, Google. Well done.
Google. What are you doing, Google? Like, what are you doing with your app store? It's stupid. Don't do it.
What are you doing with your lives?
Like, yeah, just stop it. Do something else.
I mean, why not take a hash? Just take a hash. They're not even recompiling. Are they even recompiling? They're not, are they? I mean,
presumably they are. If they're changing the name, they probably, like, the hash is going to change too. But
are they changing, like, is that like a tag, the name, or is it the actual file name?
I don't know. Maybe they're changing some stuff inside. But the point is that they should be doing a little more.
Yes, that's right. You know,
a little more analysis than that, please.
Yes, that would be nice. I've got a story here too saying that multiple OS vendors released security patches after misinterpreting Intel docs, also by Catalin Campanu of Bleep and Computer fame. Is this as derp as the headline says?
This is actually a really interesting story that kind of got buried amongst everything else. Because, I mean, this was really the next Spectre or Meltdown in a way. It's a sort of a hardware bug in the sense that the vendors misinterpreted Intel's documentation. But the impact was, like, you got from Userland access to, like, a debug register in Ring Zero or something. I got a little bit lost. Like, basically, it's you trigger a debug exception, and then you get, like, a handle to a thing. Anyway, either way, it seemed really bad, and yet all of the operating system vendors managed to patch it simultaneously, I guess, effectively. We haven't seen any reports otherwise, and do so in a way that was, you know, coordinated and effective and not a complete disaster, which,
that's amazing.
And
no one had,
yeah, and there were no names, there was no branding. I don't think there was any branding.
How it should be done.
Well, yeah, exactly.
This is how
right.
It should be done. So kudos. Have you seen everybody involved?
Like, there's some funny dude on Twitter that's been like doing fake branding for other people's bugs.
No, I haven't seen that.
Yeah, there's a good InfoSec Twitter comedy going on. But anyway, yes, we don't talk about bug names, so let's leave that one alone.
Comedy bug of the week, Adam, you gave me this one. This is so hilarious. CVE-2018-1111.
Oh, yeah. So there was a bug in the Red Hat DHCP client, so in the bindings between the DHCP client and, like, the network manager on Red Hat. Anyway, there was OS shell meta character injection. So if you were a malicious DHCP server, you could exec code on any clients that DHCP'd off you. And yeah, that's pretty bad, because, I mean, that's like remote root by running a DHCP server, run up an access point, wait for a Red Hat box, job done. So yeah, that's pretty sweet.
But this only applies to old Red Hat, right?
No, this is like RHEL 6 and 7. That's quite a lot of important boxes. Although I guess mostly those boxes don't DHCP. Like, I'm thinking of everything that used to be Solaris that's now RHEL in the middle of all of the telcos and banks and stuff. Most of those don't DHCP, I guess, but...
But you've got to be on the network already, right?
Okay, so, yeah.
You know.
Yeah, sure.
But it's still funny. It's still funny. And I've linked through to the POC, and it's hilarious. But, Adam, that is actually it for the week's news. This is the longest news section we have ever recorded. We've just ticked over an hour in the pre-edit recording. So there you go. Smashing records. I've really enjoyed it this week, mate. Thank you very much, and we'll chat to you again next week.
Yeah, hopefully next week. Nice, simple, easy news week. We'll have a couple of shells. We can have some cheap lols, and that will be job done. So I'm looking forward to that.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. And we have one announcement this week. Chad Rickensrud and Phil Young, better known as Big Endian Smalls and Soldier of Fortran on Twitter, they are running a pen testing ZOS, like mainframe pen testing course here in Australia, in Sydney, on June 12 and 13. I'm going to link through to the sign-up page and the syllabus page And you can sign up there. It costs $2,400 Australian, which is, you know, just the training fee, obviously, not lodging or meals. And, yeah, they do all the IBM stuff, ZOS, not iSeries or AS400, just in case someone's confused there. But, look, if you're interested in learning how to pen test mainframes, these guys are the best in the business. So I would encourage you to sign up. And they've said, just in the interest of disclosure, they've said that for everyone who signs up after this announcement, they're going to give us a tiny little slice of the fee there. So you'd be helping the show as well. And they're keeping the class quite small as well. So yeah, definitely one to consider if that's a string you want to add to your bow. Okay, let's get on to this week's sponsor interview now. And this week's show is brought to you by Darktrace. Darktrace is all about applying machine learning techniques to network traffic, but they also do like network traffic blocking, right? And they're also, yeah, they're a certified tech unicorn with a valuation of over $1 billion. Now, there's lots of crazy claims made about how machine learning is going to solve all InfoSec problems. I mean, if you read most vendor marketing, you'd think, you know, we're done. The attackers have lost. You know, just real crazy claims. But conversely, there's a lot of smack talk about machine learning that I find equally ridiculous, particularly when it comes to the network side of things. I mean, if you just look at how a simple decision tree can be used to spot domain-fronted Tor traffic, and then from there, imagine what you can do with machine learning-backed network traffic profiling, then, you know, do I need to say more? Understanding network traffic isn't actually rocket science once you've built the right tools. And, you know, that's where Darktrace is trying to play. Now, there's another interesting aspect to their tech that I've mentioned, and this is what I wanted to talk to them about, and that's that it's active. Now, you might remember the IPSs of old, the ones that would spray TCP resets at anything half suspicious. Now, they dropped completely out of favor, but now this approach is coming back. Darktrace will happily snipe connections when it detects bad stuff. But what's different this time? Why was it bad then and good now? Now, in a word, according to our next guests, it's all about confidence in your detection. Darktrace's Director of Technology, Dave Palmer, and their Head of SOC and Analytics, Max Heinemeier, joined me for this interview. Dave is the English fellow and Max is the man with the wonderful accent. And I started off by asking them why connection sniping dropped by the wayside over the last 15 years or so and why it's coming back. And here's what they said.
Yeah, so I think one of the most painful things about automation and orchestration when we've been trying to build them over the last few years has been how much do you need to decide in advance before you start getting any value out of that approach. So if you need to fully understand all of your playbooks and how your security processes are going to come together, and you have to fully understand all of the business processes before you can even start to write down some of the rules that you want to be implemented, then there was probably more efficient ways of doing security. You know, for many of the different vulnerabilities that pop up, it's often easier just to patch that vulnerability than trying to orchestrate the problem out of your business. Now, there are certain places like ICS worlds where patching is difficult, of course, but for the most part, if you're in enterprise tech, you're usually better off fixing the source of the problem than you ever were orchestrating around it. And I think that's where the approach has fallen out of favor. The fastest way of dealing with it is either to wait for it to go wrong and then fix it, or to have got rid of the problem at source.
Yeah, so that's interesting what you say, right? Because a lot of those old school signatures that used to fire and cause, you know, TCP resets to start, you know, kicking people off your network, yeah, they were based on very simple things. And if you go through, and you're quite right, if you go through all of the effort of identifying the ones that are relevant to you, why not just fix the problem, right? Why not fix the root problem or mitigate it in some other way? It makes perfect sense.
And especially when you add in a lot of the responses are absolutely brutal. Even a minor signature match could get a client kicked off the network entirely. And after your IT help desk has rung you up a few times and said, look, this security process is driving us nuts. We spend more time getting people back onto the network than we were previously doing, handling just the day-to-day annoyances and infections you get from life on the internet.
Yeah, it's funny. I recently had a conversation and I'm sort of seeing how the you know, the machine learning based approach and the active stuff ties together now, because I had an interesting conversation for one of our sponsor interviews recently with Stephen Ridley of Senrio, and I feel totally comfortable naming that company in a sponsor interview for another company because there's like zero overlap in what it is that you do. But he had amazing success developing a shell detector using machine learning techniques and including being able to pick up things like batch shells, right? So shells with that aren't real-time interactive. So I'm guessing, is that the sort of stuff that you're looking for, that you're looking to snipe on the network?
So the got a lot of time for what Stephen and the Semrio guys are up to. And I think what we have in common is once you start moving to probability-based approaches, you can start making decisions not just at points in time on one or two data points, but you can start having much more context and more data involved in the calculation. So network anomalies are not unusual, right? I mean, just someone introducing a printer on your network can produce an awful lot of strange new conversations that weren't happening before. But when you start having a really rich understanding of the relationships between devices and people and how apps seem to be manifesting themselves, and you can do that not just over, say, the last 5 seconds or whatever rapid time frame perimeter defenses are operating on, but you could take into account potentially the last year's worth of behavior and peer groups and how large groups of systems interrelate with each other, then you can have much more confidence if you're then going to start making sniping decisions within the environment. And I completely agree. These approaches are a perfect fit for each other because you really want to be pretty sure if you're going to start knocking something out off of the network.
Now, look, you're one of the companies that I know is mercilessly ridiculed for, one of the many mercilessly ridiculed for talking up machine learning, right? Like, this is the thing that everyone in security is sort of doing, machine learning, but this is something quite core to your business. Like, what would you say to people who think that it's just a whole lot of hype without a lot of promise?
Honestly, I'd say, what do you think you're going to be doing in 5 years? I mean, complexity is absolutely exploding, and the amount of stuff that's going on in our digital businesses, the amount of potential that all our different systems have, if we're going to start continuing to say, right, the thing we need to do is predefine all the good things that should happen in our network, and we should predefine every bad thing that's going to happen in our network and try and lock them out. And the way that we're going to do that is we're going to hire tons and tons more people as our businesses get more and more digitized and more complex. Well, you know, we don't agree that that's the way it's going to play out. Attacks are speeding up. Ransomware is a real pain in the backside, but there are plenty other attacks that have impact quite quickly now. And there just aren't the skills to keep up with that. And I think unless you've got really deep pockets, having the amount of people you'll need on hand to even maintain where you are right now in security terms, let alone move forward, isn't going to play out unless you can really have some automation helping you out.
Yeah. Now, this is one thing that actually really frustrates me around the so-called debate around machine learning and information security is people seem to be driving it to one extreme or the other. They say, you know, machine learning is everything and it's going to solve all of our problems. We hear a lot of that emanating from the sort of vendor side of the fence. And then you hear from the pen testers and whatnot and the hacker side, it's all bullshit and it's not going to do anything. It's not going to stop anything. Whereas I seem to, from my point of view, it seems to me that really what, machine learning based approaches to this stuff are going to yield is just reducing workload a bit and helping people to only make the decisions that the machine learning can't make. Does that make sense? And I'm curious where you sit in that spectrum between saying it's going to solve everything or nothing at all. Are you saying it's going to solve everything? Are you one of those?
Well, not trying to say it's a silver bullet. I think it's very important to try to cut through the marketing. And I understand where you're coming from. I always try to compare to, and that's a symptom of our industry, I guess, in the marketing industry, in the InfoSec world, to see how we've had other trends and hypes like threat intelligence in the last 2 or 3 years. Everybody claimed to use threat intelligence and that was a new big thing in silver bullet. And a few years back when FireEye came around and went big, it was all about network sandboxing technology and APTs, sandboxes. And every vendor had one of these solutions in there bolted on. So these days it's machine learning, but you really think beyond that and try to cut through the marketing and see what the solution delivers. So what's the capabilities and solution delivers. And we've been talking about that. Darktrace looks at network traffic, spots anomalies, enables threat hunting and delivers automation. So as you say, it's exactly what we do. We try to lower the workload on the operational teams, because a major problem in our industry is that everybody is firefighting. The worst job in the world is the conveyor belt SOC operations work for IT people, where you have to sit there all day long as a junior analyst and plow through logs and logs and try to find the bad things, just burning out people. And with the cybersecurity skill gap, we can only solve the problem that far by throwing more resources at it and trying to get more people into the industry and try to train up new guys and make juniors more efficient. But looking at the other side of the medal and the coin, trying to work smarter, not harder, and get more automation into security is where machine learning comes in, I think. Especially because with machine learning on the network side of things, we can start building context. And instead of having to go through 5,000 alerts, you dwindle it down to maybe 5 a day, which makes things so much more powerful. So people can free their resources from the daily firefights in the level one SOC operations to going to more technical and strategic stuff. And instead of having to fix the issue straight away, just contain it for several hours so their staff can work on the actually interesting issues, on patching, on new business rollouts, and eventually get away from having security work against business operations, but hopefully work towards them.
See, the thing is, I'm sure there were people listening to that who thought 5 alerts a day, oh, that'll never happen. Do you know what I mean? Like that sort of quality of signaling. And I kind of think that's sad, because ultimately, when you think about the number of people like sitting there manually looking at a lot of the information that's presented to them in their SIEM or their SOC, right, they're able to very quickly dismiss a lot of things that aren't a big deal. And yet there is a great deal of suspicion around whether or not machine learning can actually do this for us. And I guess the concern is that the machine learning algorithms are going to miss something that's important. One of those 5 is going to get missed. And, you know, how do you sort of combat that thinking when you're trying to sell your product? Because that, I imagine, is quite often what you're up against.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great point, Patrick. So, of course, you always want to have a defense in depth strategy, right? You don't just want to have a solution and hope it catches everything and everybody everywhere. What's beautiful about network-based solutions like Darktrace is that we cover almost the whole kill chain, if you just exclude the initial reconnaissance and OSINT bit, because we see anything from initial intrusions where someone downloads a weird PowerShell script from a raw external website that nobody in the whole environment ever accessed. Then there's a second stage payload coming in, and SSH tunnels being established to some rare IP address, maybe that.
Now that's the sort of stuff that machine learning kit is really good at, and it's just such standard hacker workflow, right?
Building on that point, if you miss the infection, but you start to see later stages of the attack, because the machine learning systems can hold long-term context, they basically can become more and more suspicious about what you're up to. And when you add that to active response, what you can do is essentially do the opposite and say, okay, I'm more and more suspicious that Dave's laptop is behaving in ways that are inappropriate in the business. There's one bit in particular that I'm really worried about, say some beaconing out to Portugal or something. I'm going to shut that down and see how the machine responds next. And maybe I'll make more and more invasive response decisions over the next few seconds or minutes or hours or days if necessary. But I can wait to make my intervention decision, and I can become more and more aggressive over time. And as Max was saying, that is the benefit of being in the network and seeing the whole thing. If you're just on the perimeter, you've got one shot to make a decision, and you have to get that right. Otherwise, it's outside of your field of view. And I think that's pretty exciting, and it's expandable too. So once you start looking at the networks, and then you start integrating maybe APIs from SaaS solutions, so you can see what they're doing up in 0365 with credentials that match what's happening in the network, or you can see how they're using the email systems, or integrating with what's happening on hosts, then you can start to have a really complete view of what's happening in the digital business, and then your decision-making quality is really going up.
It's interesting too that you know, one of the reasons network stuff fell out of favor, I guess, is because, you know, a lot of attackers just discovered that if you build yourself an interactive shell that communicates as HTTPS, you know, like actually looks kind of valid on the network and everything, then most stuff's just not going to see it. That's another area where machine learning can come in quite handy, isn't it? Is spotting funny stuff encrypted. I just want to be clear, though. I just want to clarify something, though. You mentioned that you can see stuff. You can see like a machine going out to a website and downloading some weird PowerShell stuff.
you know, if they're doing that over a TLS connection, how are you going to see that? Are you doing that weird, are you doing a sort of SSL proxying thing for your customers, sort of like a Bluecoat style thing? Or are you actually able to infer that just by looking at the network metadata?
So we don't break up SSL traffic. We're not acting as a man in the middle proxy. We work on the metadata. And I was about to get to that when I started talking about the kill chain. So we don't just look at the initial payload. So if that comes in a one encrypted channel, we're not going to see the exact data coming down. We do TPK inspection if we can do DPI. But if we can't, we can't. However, there's a lot of power in the metadata. Like, there's always going to be unusual factors, a lot of weak indicators, like the time when the connection is established, how rare the endpoint is on the network, what kind of requests came before the connections.
Well, and you get a lot, you get an awful lot by watching packet timing, like a crazy amount.
Yeah, the packet timing. And then there's JA3, which Salesforce open source. I don't know if you come across that just a few months ago, which looks as SSL client hello packet handshaking. And there's a lot of power there. So what I'm trying to say is there's a lot of weak indicators, even in encrypted connections, which makes picking out the weird and anomalous stuff, especially if you think about command control traffic and beaconings, so repeated connections, pretty simple, especially or even in fact if you look at encrypted connections. So we don't need to break it up. And if we miss the initial payload, there's going to be follow-up activity on the kill chain where there's going to be beaconing happening, then there's going to be some lateral movement, maybe over SMB3, which is going to be encrypted again, but based on the connections, the clients talking to unusual hosts at weird times of the day. There's many, many weak indicators, as Dave said earlier, which we all take into context over a long period of time to build up this picture of normal activity versus unusual activity and make these things stand out. So a lot of the times when we see pen testers or red teams or after intrusions, it's not about spotting just a single part of the kill chain. Maybe you miss the initial intrusion for some reasons, but it's like a multi-layered defense in depth in itself, because at some point the attacker is going to trip up, be it in the command control phase, be it in the data exfiltration phase, be it in the lateral movement phase. And that's really the beauty of network-based solutions if you have all the context with the machine learning.
I think it's just worth remembering that there's some places where active response is not a super idea. So a really great example I would give is, I think you could put active response around an ICS environment or on the borders between ICS environments and the enterprise, or managed suppliers and internet connections and VPNs, etc. But you don't really want active response in the middle of your safety systems.
Yeah, no, it's okay, Dave. I'm guessing that active response sniping connections to actual SCADA controllers, making things going boom, not a good idea. And yeah, probably a violation of your terms of service. If not, it should be.
Yeah, exactly that.
One last thing I want to mention is, because we talked about sniping connections all the time, the interesting aspect for me in our active defense based on the machine learning is where we don't just snipe single connections, but we enforce known good patterns of life. So we've seen many cases where a user gets hit by some form of malware, ransomware, crypto mining, whatever, and they often don't even notice that they're being isolated on the network because we enforce the known good pattern of life. So whatever the user has done in the past, just browsing the internet, sending emails, is still going to be enabled. So business operations is not impacted, where in the past, in traditional systems, often you just fully isolate, quarantine the whole device because you only could either snipe the single connection or do full quarantine. So based on the context we have previously, we can put users and devices in a box and say, this is the border which you can go to, and this is all the things you can do, but beyond the normal activity we've learned from you, we can't go any further. So I think it's crucial to get this across, to see that there's more than just sniping single connections and reliving the whole IPS idea.
All right, Max Heinemeier and Dave Palmer, thanks a lot for joining us to talk about your approach to the machine learning thing and bringing back the BIF. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks, Pat. Real pleasure.
Thanks, Patrick.
That was Dave Palmer and Max Heinemeier there of Darktrace, and you can find them at darktrace.com. And that is it for this week's show. I'll be back with this week's feature interview later in the week, but until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.